Everyone's asleep.
Fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you quite likely go friggin' nuts. It's a show where we don't really do any research on the guests, which is why the first question, ask them who they are and what they do, as I will ask of my current guest, Jack Ellis, who is an author of Prophecy, Challenging and Blessing, Visions of 2012 and The Shift. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Vinny. It's an honor to be here, and greetings to all of my relations out there in internet radio land.
Indeed, indeed. So why don't you elaborate on just who you are and your works and such?
Oh, ask me something easy, would you please? I don't know what to do on that. I'm an author and a spiritual
We've got 2 hours. We've got 2 hours, so
okay,
don't worry.
Okay, well, let's just spend the whole 2 hours on just this one question, okay?
Yeah.
I'm an author. I'm a spiritual teacher. I've written 3 books, 2 DVDs in the last 10 years. And my books focus on aware of Mount Shasta. It's a wonderful spiritual sacred site, if you will. Mount Shasta is a beautiful dormant volcano that... that's snow-capped just about all year round. And it's a very sacred spiritual place, very powerful spiritual vortex. And I was drawn here about a year or so ago, a couple times of ours. My books deal with what I refer to as the shift, or the great shift of the ages, which refers to these times, these incredible times that we're living in, of monumental transformation that we're currently in the midst of. It's quite a hot topic these days, and there's a lot of misunderstanding and confusion about the shift in terms of this becoming a very popular topic. So, you know, in many cases, when something becomes popular, a lot of people jump into the mix, and everybody's got their opinion, and everybody's got something to say about it, and these topics oftentimes can become very diluted, and they can become very overly complicated, overly confusing, and things like that. So my primary objective has been to deliver a message about the shift, about 2012 and the shift, that strips away all those things. It strips away the unnecessary complexity and confusion and fear dealing with a topic like this, attempting to get to what people really need to know about it and doing it in a way that is understandable and not overly intellectual or overly complicated or too much of a head game or anything like this, because this definitely is not a head game. This is a much more of an experiential thing that we're talking about, as opposed to just something we do in between our ears. And that's it in a nutshell. In terms of who I could go on answering this question this is about the third major. I've been through many things in my life. And being the what I'm doing currently has been going on for about the last 10 years now. Prior to that, I was a psychotherapist in private practice in Santa Barbara, California for about 15 years. And I've been through very, very many major changes myself in my life in terms of I haven't just done one thing in my life. I've done many, many different things, all kind of culminating in what's happening now. And that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Okay. So do you have a reason for doing this? Because I found whenever people get activated in a non-conventional field, it's either one or two reasons. Usually they'll be highly performing individuals in the professional sector in some capacity, whether that be a doctor or a journalist or whatever, and then they'll see something that changes their perspective forever and they can never go back to doing it. And the other end of it is you are born into a family that has politics and the alternative fields on the mind and around the dinner table, so it's kind of inevitable. Would you fit into either of those two?
I would definitely not fit in the latter category. No, I was not brought in. What I am these days is a result of me rebelling against the family that I was born into. So what I'm presenting is I was the black sheep, and so that's definitely not the case. I did not learn any of this from my family of origin. I've always felt different. I've always felt like there was something. I've always felt like there was something incredibly wrong with with Western civilization and with the world that I was born and raised into. Even as a small child, it seemed like there was something incredibly wrong about a world in which humanity seemed to be botching it so badly in terms of making a mess of things on planet Earth. Even as a small child and even as a teenager, that just never made sense to me in terms of it always seemed to me like, human beings, if we are indeed creatures of in a divinely ordered universe, that why would the divine spirit of a living universe create creatures who were so totally incapable of managing their own existence and messing up, life on this beautiful planet in the way that humanity was. That never made any sense to me. And I was told that, the reason for this was that, we human beings were just, we were just greedy and we were just, savages and we just didn't know any better and we were ignorant and therefore we were just mucking everything up. And, of course, because of that, we needed help from, systems outside of us, to help us. We were incapable of getting it right ourselves. That never made sense to me, and when I was, old enough really to be able to start making decisions for myself and thinking for myself, I kind of launched out on a path of trying to figure out, what was really going on in the world, and what's the explanation for these things that just don't make any sense whatsoever. I didn't believe that I was like that, that I as a human being was like that. I didn't believe I was, genetically predisposed just to screw everything up in this beautiful world that we've been brought into. So I set out to find some answers and to make sense out of all this, and I basically, and also to do whatever I could do to make it better. I've always felt called in my life, to try to make the world a better place to live in, and to try to do what I could do to play my part, to change the world and to make it a better place. And so when I started learning these things, and when I started, moving, outside of the box of traditional thinking, I started doing. I'm 63 years old now, so I'm kind of an old geezer. And so I started doing this I was a college student then in the late 60s, early 70s, so I was a part of that whole, hippie counterculture revolution that happened in those days, which also was a wonderful blessing for me because that was really the first introduction I had, to moving outside of the box and to thinking in an outside-of-the-box kind of way. And started uncovering, a lot of the... a lot of the truth about how the world really works, and also started rediscovering my own spirituality as far as, I as a human being was not this greedy, avaricious, ignorant, aggressive animal that was just going to screw everything up, the way we were told, but that I was, in fact, a multidimensional spiritual being who, had supernatural powers, if I would set out to develop those abilities. So this has basically been a life's calling for me, and it's I've been continuing along this theme now for over about 40 years or so in a lot of different capacities, just doing a lot of different things. And I very much feel like, you know, where I've arrived at now is kind of a culmination of all this. And so I hope that answers your question in terms of this has just been a lifelong calling for me. And that's the answer to the question.
I understand what you mean. Being 6 foot four, it dawned on me at an early age that I wasn't going to fit in. And it's not just about how large I am. It's also how I think, how many boundaries and things that I push, how curious I am. Because people don't like to push boundaries. They like to stay behind them and feel safe by them. Whereas I've always felt that if I didn't know what's beyond the boundary, that it could be dangerous or threatening to me. And so I'd best go and try and understand as much about these unknown things as possible so that it doesn't just reach up and bite me in the ass one day.
Right. I can definitely relate to that. I've never been a person who's been just comfortable just staying in my comfort zone, which is basically, you know, what you're describing. And most people do just want to stay in their comfort zone, and I think that's one of the reasons why our world is so screwed up, and why so many people really are so unfulfilled in so many ways. Because I really believe that we as human beings, if we stay in our comfort zone, in other words, what is our comfort zone? Our comfort zone would then be, we graduate from high school and we go to college, we get a degree, we get a job, we get married, we have kids. We get a career, you know, we work for 40 years and then we retire and, you know, theoretically we, you know, spend the last, you know, 10 or 20 years of our life just, you know, playing golf or something like that. Well, the reason that, you know, the fact that people do that is one of the reasons why so many people are as unfulfilled as they are, because staying in a comfort zone like that can be very, very, it can be a very, very stagnant, you know, place to be, a very stagnant place to live in terms of if we just stay in our comfort zone.
On that point, you're correct about the stagnation, and I think about society as kind of like a stagnant pond. And in a stagnant pond, where does the scum go? Straight
nowhere.
To the top. Straight to the top.
Right. Well, it doesn't go anywhere. It just stays there and makes things sick.
Mm.
Exactly.
Mm. And that's maybe a metaphor for our times, don't you think? We've got this layer of scum on top that's preventing the light and everything else from coming through.
And that's one of the reasons why so many people are as afraid as they are today also, because of, you know, we basically are living in a time right now where, whether people like it or not, our world is changing. You know, people are waking up in mass, as you know, with a show like yours. You know, people are waking up in mass to the fact that the world works very differently than we were all conditioned to believe. And the world is changing right now. Our old paradigm world is collapsing, you know, before our eyes. And we have a tremendous opportunity, with this shift that I refer to create something better. But the fact that so many people, you know, so desperately want to stay in their comfort zone and so desperately want to cling to those old paradigm realities and that old paradigm lifestyle is one of the reasons why they're so afraid. Because at this particular point, that just isn't a possibility anymore. It just isn't a possibility for things to stay the way they've been for the last, you know, I could say 200 years, or I could say 6,000 years. You know, however you want to look at it, whatever version of history you've accepted, and the fact that people are clinging to their comfort zone and are clinging to this old paradigm, these old paradigm realities in this old paradigm world to such a degree, is one of the reasons why people are so afraid. We are living in an age where it's necessary to embrace transformation, to embrace change, and to embrace this wonderful awakening where we're discovering, you know, that the world is, in fact, very different. And even though when we first discover that, as you know, being a conspiracy guy, when we first discover those things, it can be really, you know, unsettling, and it can just make us a little crazy in terms of, you know, blowing our circuits and making us angry, and, you know, how can anybody ever, you know, survive all this insanity? Without embracing this change and without embracing this awakening that is now, you know, an opportunity that we have, this is one of the reasons why people are so afraid, because, they're clinging to, you know, old paradigm energies and clinging to their comfort zone, you know, as opposed to embracing the transformation that is, you know, right at all of our fingertips, you know, to embrace if we so choose to do so. And, once we do that, you know, once we overcome, you know, our fears of change, fear of change basically is the primary fear that, you know, that most people are stuck in. once we overcome this fear of change, and once we embrace these transformative energies, and once we embrace this tremendous awakening, you know, awakening to the truth about our world, it's a wonderful, wonderful, enlightening, and joyful, and beautiful experience, you know, to be a part of all that. But it is a process. There's a lot of growth and that's involved in that. A lot of personal evolution is involved in all this, and it takes a lot of personal work. You know, I certainly have done my own. I certainly have been doing my own personal work, you know, over the last 40 years or so, and gotten to the point now where I can embrace these things as opposed to fighting them. And at this point, you know, it is indeed, you know, it's a wonderful thing, you know, as opposed to being, you know, something we should all dread and be afraid of.
Well, I don't know. I think it's kind of it's kind of both, right? On the one thing, you can dread it, and on the other hand, you can be happy about it. Kind of like, again, go back to me being tall. When I was younger, I had really, really bad growing pains, but those made me even taller. Right? So if we've got bad psychological pains and things like that, and we've got to, oh, now I have to accept this reality, and I have to look at this possibility, etc., etc., you actually might freak out a little bit, but you will become a better person through doing it.
I think freaking out is a very healthy and good thing. I think it's good for everybody to freak out a little bit every once in a while. I think I freak out on almost a daily basis, you know, in terms of And I think it's a good thing. Change is a wonderful thing. We just need to understand it. We need to learn to, you know, to resonate with it, as opposed to fighting it. You know, anytime we fight anything, it's never a good thing to fight anything. It's always much better to flow with things as opposed to pushing against them. So, but that's something that we all need to learn. You know, it's hard at first, and I don't mean to be insensitive to people who are experiencing, you know, a lot of fear at the changes in our world today. I don't mean to be insensitive to that, because I know how hard that can be for people, particularly awakening, you know, to the truth about how our world really works. You know, that's a real shock for a lot of people, and really, knocks them off their foundation. But so this takes some work, and it takes some time, and it's a process. But hey, what better thing do we have to do with our time, you know, as opposed to learn and to awaken and to evolve? You know, what better thing do we have to do with our time? And what better thing do we have to do with our time than to play our part in attempting to, you know, to make the world a better place, which is one of the things clearly that you're doing with, a show like this. And I commend you for that. It's, one of the signs.
Well, hold on. We're coming to break now. And you're right. What better thing to do with your time? And the other side of the coin is, what can you do now that they ain't going to take away from you in the end anyway? So you might as well do it now, because you've got nothing to lose. We'll be right back.
There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome to the Vinny Eastwood Show, right here on BusinessFreedomRadio.com. A very special guest, Jack Ellis, with us. Just a little bit of history repeating. So, yeah, appropriate song, don't you think, Jack? Jack, are you there?
Song. I'm sorry, what was it?
The lyric is, it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Ah, okay. Yes, very appropriate.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
You do see the same thing over and over. And you talked about a consciousness shift and 2012 and all of that kind of stuff in your book. So could we quantify whether or not this happened before?
Whether or not a shift like this and a shift in consciousness has ever happened before?
There's other predictions about 2012. Like I've seen it break down like this. It's either A1, the end of the world, you know, the return of the destroyer, Planet X, blah blah blah, and we're all dead, or it's a wave energetic kind of shift in the galactic alignment, and we all turn into, you know, beings of much more evolved caliber. or it's all to try and psyop that the New World Order is using to distract everybody and think, into thinking, oh, it's the end of the world, we're all going to die, I'm not going to do anything against the New World Order.
Well, it's let me give my read on the whole thing. First of all, has anything like this ever happened before? The answer to that would be yes. And here again, we get into versions of history. I know that I'm always comfortable when I know that I'm going to be on a show that's not afraid to delve into the conspiracy aspect of things, because that way I don't ever have to be afraid that what I say might be a little bit too, a little bit too wild and crazy, you know, for people in your audience. But has this ever happened before? Yes, this has happened before. This has happened before because this is an aspect of a 26,000-year cycle. And so this has happened before in terms of the last time this happened was 26,000 years ago. And we're not real clear on what was happening 26,000 years ago because our history's been so distorted, you know, that we just really, kind of lose track about those things, and we can really only hypothesize. In my humble opinion, our best source, and the message that you're going to hear from me, Vinny, really is a very, what I refer to as an indigenous message, as in the message that has been prophesized and delivered by indigenous people from all over the planet. In particular, the Maya for me recently, because I hooked up with a Mayan elder about 3 years ago by the name of Tata Eric Gonzalez, who's located, who has a home and is in the process of building a community about an hour north of where I am right now in Mount Shasta, about an hour north of here up in the mountains. And about 3 years ago or so, I met Tata Eric, and I kind of agreed that he was going to be my next teacher. And I think we can all benefit from having teachers from time to time. I know that, I had a teacher for many, many years, and in 1991, I severed my relationship with that teacher, not because there was anything wrong with the relationship, just because I felt like I had learned those lessons, and, you know, it was time for me to be on my own for a while, and then perhaps to find a new teacher, you know, when I was ready for that. And I was looking, you know, for a new teacher for many, many years, never found one, because nobody ever really resonated with what I was looking for. Until about 3 years ago when I met this Mayan elder. And the original teachings of the ancient Maya, as were transmitted through Tata Eric, were just so beautiful and just resonated so perfectly with everything that I was looking for that I consented, you know, to allow him to be my teacher, and he has been for about 3 years now. So what you hear coming from me is a very indigenous message, in particular the Maya, but all the indigenous people are basically telling us exactly the same thing. So, you know, the Maya are telling us the same thing as the Hopi are telling us the same thing as the Kogi are telling us the same thing as virtually all of them. When we begin to examine history, you know, our real history as opposed to our fabricated history, in my opinion, the best sources of history are, in fact, the indigenous people, and looking into the lore of the indigenous people and looking into their interpretations of history, because, you know, their view of the world and their understanding of the world is something that really has not been, and it's very refreshing to have something like this. It's really something that has not been tampered with. And when you think of the comparison between that and our history and virtually all of the information that we're, brainwashed with in our culture, all of which has been so hideously tampered with, it's wonderful to be exposed to a message that is indeed, you know, pure and clean, and it's the same message that it was, you know, 10,000 years ago. So, for me, that was a very wonderful thing. So, in terms of learning about these historical cycles, in my opinion, one of the best sources of our information are the ancient indigenous teachings from virtually all of the cultures from all around the planet, and virtually all of them also agree with these cycles of history that we refer to. And the shift of the ages is indeed this 26,000-year cycle. That can be explained in many different ways. In terms of can be explained in terms of astrological alignments, and it can be explained in terms of several other things also. So, has anything like this ever happened before? On the basis of my understanding of it, and on the basis of real history as opposed to fabricated history, the closest that we can come to something like this happening happened approximately 13,000 years ago, which was about the midway point, you know, through this 26,000-year cycle. And it was at that point where apparently, our world experienced it was at that point where other civilizations were in fact, in place upon the planet, And, you know, you hear about Atlantis and Lemuria and those types of things, where other ancient civilizations were, in fact, in place at that time. And it was at that time where our planet and our world experienced, a rather vast facelift. And we hear of this in many of the ancient sacred texts, you know, again, from spiritual traditions. We hear of an ancient flood. And we hear of, you know, continents rising and falling, you know, based upon this massive earth change that was happening at that time, and also a change in the civilization that was happening at that time also. You know, the end of one civilization, meaning, you know, the possibility, you know, or the opportunity, you know, to begin, you know, a new civilization, you know, from the ashes of the old. So has this ever happened before? Yes, this is a function of a 26,000 year cycle, and we're at that 26,000 year year turnover point. You know, where we've reached the end of one aspect of the cycle, which simply means we are at the beginning of the opportunity to create, you know, the beginning, you know, of the new aspect of the cycle. And as far as what all this, you know, means.
You said this new aspect of the cycle. I mean, it's like, I don't know, fire and water, and these other elemental kind of things that exist sort of in a natural environment. You see how they kind of come together, they destroy each other, but they also give birth to each other kind of thing, if you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like a tsunami will, you know, expand the ocean, take away the land and whatever, or a volcano will spew forth toxic stuff, but it becomes fertile soil. Is there a similar process here, do you think, that through an element of this event, whatever it might be, that there's kind of a rebirth scenario out of it?
Absolutely, and you said that beautifully. I don't even know, I can't even really embellish upon that too much. That's how these cycles work. These cycles are basically, they're the same cycle, the same type of a cycle as the cycle we are very, very familiar with, and this being the cycle of birth, life, death, and then regeneration or rebirth. It's a very ancient. It's a very ancient thing. It's a very repeating thing, and you know, this is the kind of cycle that we're dealing with. So it's the cycle of life, death, and then rebirth from that. So,
can I ask as well on that point? If we are talking about cycles, or using the elemental analogy, did the ancients have any knowledge of perhaps entities that are elementals or things of that nature?
Well, absolutely. When we're talking about elemental, when we need to be careful in our use of terms here, because we have the term element and then we have the term elemental. And an element would be more of a physical thing, such as fire, earth, air or water. And then as I understand it in the metaphysical system that I'm currently working in, an elemental then would be the spirit essence of those various elements. So there's a spirit essence of the fire, a spirit essence of the water, of the air, and also of the water. And when we're dealing, when you ask about entities, the entities that I'm familiar with and the entities that I deal with are the entities from the spirit world. And you know, we have a material world, you know, what that we're all very, very familiar with, in which our old paradigm world actually emphasizes this material world to the exclusion of all else. But that's not all the world consists of. Our world is much more other dimensional than that. That's one of many, many dimensions is the material dimension, and we often refer to that as the third dimension or the third dimensional material world. But then, in addition to these physical elements, we also have the spirit essence of those physical elements, which are, you know, indeed entities, but they're spiritual entities, and so we, you know, the relationship we have with them.
They're simply non-physical entities, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And when you study the indigenous traditions and the indigenous metaphysics, they are just, you know, it's an absolute essential feature of these systems and of these you know, metaphysical systems. The spirit world is an absolute essential aspect of those systems, and it's actually more of an essential part of their world than the material world actually is. You know, their world, Well, one of the primary dividing points here is the division between matter and spirit. And one of the things that is one of the reasons why our current world has reached its demise is because this is a world that emphasizes the material to the exclusion of the spiritual. And this will inevitably lead to a tremendous state of imbalance because, you know, things always need to be in balance, you know, whatever you're talking about. And when we're talking about
A detachment from higher consciousness, detachment from spirituality, and in essence, losing a hold of the bedrock of on which you stood and allowing the current to take you where it whims.
Yes. With the bedrock here that we're speaking of, that the indigenous traditions are built on, is the bedrock of their connection with spirit, and also the bedrock of their connection with the web of life, you know, as spirit, you know, manifests itself and shows itself, you know, in the material world. In other words, when they look at the world, they just don't see a bunch of lumps of matter. You know, they see a world that consists of matter, and they also see a world that consists of matter which is imbued with spirit, which is a completely different world. It's a completely different way of seeing the world. It's a completely different way of relating to the world. And this spirit that we refer to is the thing that has been extracted, you know, from our current, you know, old paradigm, Western civilization. The spirit we're talking about is the very element which has been extracted, you know, from this old paradigm world, which is the reason why this world has lost its life, basically, and which is the reason why this world is in a state of demise and in a state of collapse. But the good news is we as human beings, have an opportunity, you know, to learn these things and to get it right and to get it right this time. You know, just because our civilization has fallen into this trap does not mean that we as individuals, you know, must fall into the same trap. You know, we don't. You know, we can choose to reorder our priorities, you know, to place our primary emphasis in life once again upon our connection with spirit and once again upon our connection with serving the web of life. And on that basis, you know, we can get everything in the proper order again. And we can, you know, play our part in creating a new world, creating a better world.
Mm-hmm. I see it like this. Anybody who sits around waiting for a particular date to get off their ass, obviously probably ain't going to do a hell of a lot even when that date comes.
That's an excellent point. That's an excellent point. And that is one of the primary mistakes also that so many people, even people who are very involved and interested in what I'm talking about here, in the shift and in this time of transformation and everything. So many of them are so obsessed with dates and predictions and being told what's going to happen that they do just exactly what you said. They sit on their butt and they sit around and they wait for something to happen to them as opposed to, and this is where they really get it wrong, and this is where we as a species, you know, need to change and need to get this right. It's not a question of waiting for things to happen to us. You know, it's a question of taking the appropriate steps to play our part in making things happen. And when we create a better world, or when we create the new earth, this new earth we're talking about must consist of human beings who primarily take responsibility, you know, for making their lives happen. They're not just sitting around and waiting to be taken care of by the government or waiting to be taken care of by, you know, there's a lot of systems and a lot of entities out there that are more than happy to, to take care of us from cradle to grave and to do all our thinking for us and to do all that. And meanwhile, we just become, you know, lumps of flesh that are basically, you know, devoid of spirit and not very healthy. So it's a question of us learning this, flipping this around, and reassuming complete responsibility for our own lives, for living our own lives, and reassuming responsibility for making these things happen. And unless we do that, nothing's going to happen. Things are just not going to change, or bad things are going to happen.
Well, it seems remarkably logical, Jack, that if you do nothing, things going to happen. People don't get that. You know, it's pretty straightforward. You do something, something happens. I don't know why people don't have that figured out yet. We'll be right back after the break.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe
what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know about the bleeding uranium in the mortar? What you know about AIPAC controlling the reporter? What's wrong with the world? People kill people that other people command. Middle East is a modern day attack on a native land. Project eugenics, land on the common man, expand the military industrial
complex. That song is by Genocide. You can get his album Classified Intelligence at genocidewrap.com. A little bit of a plug for him. And also a quick plug for myself. I've moved into a new studio, so now if you want to be interviewed by me, you can actually come into the studio and be live here with me and such on the webcam. Wouldn't that be choice? So that's an option. So if you're a New Zealand activist or even somebody who happens to be in New Zealand, this is now an option. And that's all because of you, the listeners, donating in order to help with the moving costs. Unfortunately, because rent is like an extra $100 a week, it means that I'm basically going to have to ask desperately, no kidding, if people can subscribe for $5 a month or $40 a month or $100 a month. Anything like that would help out really, really significantly because, basically, I don't know how to make money. It's really hard to find out how to make money out of telling the truth. Whereas back in the days when I was a salesman, I got told what to say and got paid to say it. This is a different game altogether. So I need your support, ladies and gentlemen. If you can donate or recurring donate, there is both a donate button and a subscribe button if you want to do recurring, and there is also the bank account for Guerrilla Media there on the homepage of the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. We really, really need your support and of course greatly appreciate it when we do get it. And if you can't, I've had a lot of people apologize for not being able to help me, mate, take care of yourself first. Okay, don't burden yourself trying to support somebody else just because you want to support them. Only do it if you can. And if you can't, you might know somebody who can. Okay? Pass the buck. Put your feeder tentacles out there. Don't put too much pressure on yourself. Okay? You didn't force yourself into this radio show or anything like that, so you don't have the same obligations as I do. So don't beat yourself up about it. All right? It's my fault, really. My very special guest, Jack Ellis, apologize for the self-plugging. Apparently, a lot of people don't like it when hosts do that on their shows. But, yeah. Which reminds me, what's your website and your book so people can visit it and buy it?
Well, sure. Thank you for that. My most recent book is entitled Prophecy, Challenge, and Blessing, Visions of 2012 and the Shift. My most recent DVD is entitled 2012 and the Shift, The Power of Ceremony. And you can purchase these, and I have two other books, and I have another DVD, and you can get those. You can purchase those at my website, www.jackallis.com. My last name is spelled A-L-L-I-S, so that's jackallis.com. I've got a lot of other goodies on my website, too. I've got a lot of videos, a lot of audios, interviews like this one, links to interviews like this one, audios, videos, and I would also like to very strongly encourage people to subscribe to my email list, simply because it's such a great way for me to stay in touch, and I send out a monthly newsletter, which is kind of just keeping people informed about what's happening in this area of 2012 and the shift, in this area of all these transformative energies and these transformations that our world is in the process of experiencing right now. And plus, that's such a wonderful way for me to keep in touch with people. So, and that's, Vinny, that's how I learn. You know, I don't read newspapers anymore. I don't watch television. I think the last time I watched the news on television was probably 9/11. You know, I was so fascinated by what they were doing that I couldn't take my eyes off it on that particular day. And I knew what was going on at that time. I had already, awakened myself, and so I could see through it, as it was happening. And that's how I learn about things. I learn about things by subscribing to people's newsletters and I learn about things by, getting into my inbox every day and just, seeing what people are doing and reading the newsletters people are sending out and those sorts of things. So it's a good way for me to stay connected with people, and it's a good way for other people to stay informed about what's going on in the world. So I'd like to invite people to do that. And thank you for the opportunity.
That's good there. And as well, I mean, I've done similar stuff. Like basically, if you want to do what you want to do, you got to figure out what you don't want to do and cut it out of your daily life, kind of thing. Like, for instance, I want to interview authors and I don't want to read their books. So instead of you know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't read articles on the internet anymore. I actually just send an email to the author and ask them to come on and have a chat about it, that kind of thing. In essence, I've cut myself off at the knees in many ways, but I'm standing on the shoulders of giants and so many others.
Well, you're getting the job done, and you're saving time reading all those books too. Some of those books probably really, really suck, you know. Not mine.
Well, there's a trick my producer told me, and I haven't taken him up on it yet, but if you're interviewing somebody who's an author, you read the first chapter and the last chapter.
That'll work. Or how about just read the, read if they've got a, like a synopsis of their book, you know, on the back cover or on the inside back cover. Just read that, you know.
Yeah. Or what I've done, actually, I've done something even naughtier. I get my missus to read the books that my interviewer sent me.
I once learned a wonderful trick in college. I was a very slow learner, a very slow reader, and I had somebody once said, you know, there's no way you can get through college reading this slowly. You have to learn how to either read faster or you have to learn how to, you know, somehow how to pass those tests. And somebody told me once, when you're reading a book, particularly like a text-type book, all you read are chapter headings, subtitles. You read the first sentence of every paragraph and the last sentence of every paragraph, and if there's any summaries, read those. Skip all the rest, and that's what I did basically for 4 years of college, and I was basically an A student. So, a lot of people
sounds
waste a lot of time with a lot of words that they don't need to be, that they don't need to be reading. One of the things that I pride myself on in the books that I write is that I pride myself on not wasting people's time with a lot of extraneous words. I think it's very important for us to express ourselves, you know, concisely, clearly, in a conceptually clear way, and simply. You know, anytime you're talking to somebody who's a so-called authority or a master or whatever they call themselves, and if they're making their topic, you know, excessively complicated or confusing or, you know, what the hell is he talking about, that's not a good way to present your message. You know, I think any good teacher, any good, person that's, wise in any particular area, usually is somebody who, you know, you hear them speak and you go, wow, it's so simple. He's making it sound so simple. I never realized that, you know, that it was that way. You know, those are the kinds of people that I want to listen to, and those are the kinds of people I want to read, not somebody who's going to, you know, clutter everything up with a lot of stuff that, you know, doesn't need to be there.
It reminds me of a time I was sitting in my mate's room, and his friend was looking over these long kind of law philosophical journals. You know how when you go to university, you get those big printout booklets that cost you like $10 or whatever, and full of all this this language that you can't understand. It's just pages and pages and pages and pages of BS, right? Mm-hmm. And I said to her, look, the reason why I left university partly is because it was all convoluted. Okay, and it's my contention then, as it still is now, that the point of higher education is to fog your mind with bollocks so that you can't actually think, even if you wanted to.
I have a theory about that also. I believe that a lot of the reasons things are so cloudy and things are so confusing, it's a way that those particular people have, whether they be lawyers, whether they be doctors. It's a way that they have of monopolizing that information. Because, I mean, if everybody understood it, then you wouldn't have to spend, you know, $500 an hour to go to a lawyer. If everybody understood it, you wouldn't have to spend, you know, however much money you spend to go to a doctor. If they make it so confusing, you know, that you need them to explain it to you, you know, then basically they're monopolizing the information and they're making a lot of money doing it. So,
not entirely dissimilar from the Vatican.
You know?
It sounds a lot like the methodology of the Vatican and reading, writing Bibles only in Latin, so only the priests could understand what was going on there.
There you go, and I think the Vatican probably is a player in all of this, as well as the lawyer and the lawyers and the doctor. Sure, I'll go along with that.
And we all play our parts, right? And what I found is when you're trying to figure out what you want to do with your life, what you're really trying to do is figure out your part in the grand design, the grand scheme. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I don't know how to determine that. I mean, I fell into a thing that was kind of natural for me, and things were given to me that led me down this path. You know, the radio show was given to me, blah, 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 blah. But I think it was ultimately my work experience that forced me out of the workforce, basically. I was real top salesman, blah, 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 you know, register Eskimo type guy, making the money. But whenever I wanted to get higher up in the organization, whenever I wanted to start making decisions for myself, whenever I wanted to start doing the right thing by the customer instead of just the right thing by the company, as soon as I started going outside the list of parameters I was supposed to follow, even though it would have improved the company, even though it would have improved the people working there, I got fired every time, you know. And that's the system in and of itself. I figured that, oh, my God, that's not just one job that was like that. That happened to me thrice in a row. So it is not just these places where we go and these things that we do that can signify how screwed up the world is. The reality is you can look in any direction. And when you try to find your place in it, what you're really looking for is a way out. No, you don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to work for a scumbag boss anymore. I don't want to be forced to tell people things that aren't true just in order to collect a paycheck. Frack that. Okay? Do you think we're ever going to evolve out of any type of scenario that humanity's already gone through over and over and over again? False flag terrorism, vaccines, corporate scumbaggery, the whole chain of events. It's all stayed that way because very few people have been looking for an out of the system. And so by natural, I think by natural events or the grace of God or whatever you want to call it, I've found out the ultimate out, and that's to get hooked up. We'll be right back after the break with Jack. In Talk Radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's our original theme song there from Unity Pacific. My mate Tingyalo Ness from the Polynesian Panthers here in New Zealand. And I love it when people call me a racist, and then I show them a video that I've done standing up for all these different oppressed races and stuff like that. It's hilarious. And have you noticed how every time somebody on YouTube or whatever accuses you of something, they're always wrong because they're accusing you of something rather than asking a question before they know anything about you. And I'm sure you know exactly what that's all about, don't you, Jack Ellis, my very special guest?
Yes, I do. There's an incredible vigilanteism in our world today, I think, that is being promoted by the internet. I think one of the bad things about the internet is that it gives a lot of people a very false sense of power. And you know, in terms of, you know, anybody can say anything and can go anywhere and can put up all these websites and do all this stuff. And a lot of that is just very foundationless. And I've noticed that there's a very intense kind of vigilante element to the internet these days in terms of just, you know, getting people. Just get them no matter what. And if anybody speaks out about anything, just get them or expose them. And I don't know, you've probably been exposed before in terms of, you know, people have heard you express, you know, an opinion that they didn't like or that was too far outside the box or whatever. And then they, you know, they endeavor to expose you. They expose that you're a fraud and blah, 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 and then say all these things that they can post in various places and all this nasty stuff. And a lot of that didn't exist before the internet, at least not in this not in the same way, because people didn't have the same type of a medium, you know, with which to do these things. So yes, indeed.
And I find what it is like people are unwilling to listen to a certain amount, like even in the conspiracy research movement. Like, let's say take 9/11 truth, for instance. You start talking about 2012 phase shifts or quantum mechanics or physics or anything like that, and they call you dangerous or a conspiracy theorist. And it's like, well, hold on a second. These people have awakened more than most, kind of thing, but they haven't gone all the way, not by a long shot.
Well, and also when you look at the word conspiracy, when you define the word conspiracy, there's really nothing, and people say, oh, you know, it's almost like calling somebody a bad name or something. You know, it's like calling you evil, or it's like calling you, you know, something nasty, some kind of an obscenity or something. But when you define the word conspiracy, there's really nothing bad about that. You know, a conspiracy theorist is simply somebody who exposes something that's going on behind the scenes, you know, that's being done for some sort of a malevolent purpose. You know, that's really all that it is.
I have my own definition. A conspiracy theorist is a person who believes that there are powerful people in this world that have a lot of influence, who use their power to gain more influence.
Right, but an essential element of the definition is that this is done behind the scenes. Conspiracy isn't something that's out in the open. It's something that's, you know, covert. It's hidden. It's like tricky, and that's But all that you said was valid in terms of powerful people who endeavor to get control, but they endeavor to do it covertly, you know, through trickery, you know, as opposed to just coming right out in the open and doing it. You know, Hitler was doing it more out in the open, even though there certainly was a conspiracy element to what he was doing doing. But, you know, they're doing it behind the scenes as opposed to just coming out and doing it in the open.
Mm-hmm. And the two most, poignant.
Conspiracy theorist, I say, well, you know, thank you very much. You know, yes, I am. Yeah. I'm rather
take it as a compliment.
Too.
Yeah, my girlfriend called me weird last night, and she said that's a compliment, by the way, because if you weren't weird, you wouldn't be wacky and interesting enough. You know what I'm saying? And when we talk about false flags or whatever, and you reference Germany there, two false flags in Germany. Anybody can look up. It's mainline history. The Reichstag fire, where the SS burned down the German parliament, and they blamed it on one retarded guy with a gasoline can. Yeah, one guy was able to burn down an entire parliament building, right? And then they used that to create a what was called the Department of Homeland Security, I think the translation was, to protect the fatherland, you know?
Right.
And the other false flag was when the German soldiers were dressed up as Polish soldiers and attacked a German radar base. Now, obviously, if you're Poland and your best soldiers and battle capacity is frickin' horseback, you know, why would you attack Germany? You know, it doesn't make any sense. But sure enough, as long as you've got state media to purport the lie, people will believe their leader.
Right, right. Uh-huh.
And voila.
There are many parallels between, like, the Reichstag fire, and it's amazing the parallels between that and some of the things that are happening nowadays, 9/11 being the most obvious, but there are so many. Oklahoma City bombing.
And we broadcast live from the future in New Zealand here, so it's already September 11th. And I think that, I don't know, maybe the 9/11 truth movement in New Zealand is waning somewhat, because I haven't seen anybody organizing protests or anything of that like for today.
I'm so disappointed that the 9/11 movement, at least in the United States, seemed to poop out. About 5 years ago or something, I thought that the 9/11 truth movement, I really thought that that was going to be something that was going to break into the mainstream. I saw no way that once presented with the arguments, you know, debunking the whole traditional, you know, 9/11 version of things, I saw no way that reasonable thinking human beings couldn't see through it and go, aha, yeah, there's something to that. But it just never got off the ground here in this country at all, in terms of it. A little bit it did, you know, in underground circles. But I thought that was going to be the thing that, and then I thought the same thing about chemtrails. I thought once the average man in the street or woman in the street is presented with, you know, the evidence about chemtrails, you know, look up at that. Let me explain to you why that's not a normal cloud and why something funny's going on here. It seemed to me that just everybody could get that, you know, that somehow, you know, clouds are different than they were 10 years ago or 20 years ago. You know, what's going on here? You know, something funny's going on. It seemed to me like any reasonable-minded person, you know, could see through that and could get it. But nope, doesn't work that way, because if somebody tells them it's a cloud and that's the way clouds look now, they accept it and that's the end of it, and, you know, there's no further discussion. So,
well, this is why I'm of the firm belief that the vast majority of the human race, particularly in Western culture, is under a form of mind control, and that being the mainstream media. This is how you control the minds of people, as you control the information that they ingest, and also with the education system. And David Icke said something to me, which I think is worth repeating. At what point throughout your schooling has the nature of reality been a question or topic of discussion in the classroom?
Right, right.
Never.
Uh-huh.
You know, people aren't meant to question the nature of reality or anything metaphysical or question the government or anything. It's not what's taught.
It's a rather intense state of numbness, is it not? Just in terms of being just completely numb and completely shut off to, you know, to everything that's actually, you know, happening right in front of your eyes. It's an incredible thing that people can be affected in that way. But there it is; it's happening. But fortunately, you and I are not in that game, and so many of your listeners aren't either. I'm so encouraged by this internet radio phenomenon that you and so many are involved in now. In terms of it's such a refreshing thing that there's so many of you, you know, exposing the truth and so many people coming to your shows and so many people waking up. It's one of those things that it's one of many things that gives me hope.
Mm-hmm. And on that point as well, I've started a little side thingy called the Vinnie Eastwood Radio Alliance. So I've got a whole bunch of different radio show hosts who are friends of mine that I have their own radio shows. And the group's just made specifically just for sharing guests' details and stuff like that. So if you allow me, I'll put your details into that group, and any of them that want to interview you will be able to.
Yeah, thank you. That'd be great. That'd be great. That'd be a good group to be connected with. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and some of your fellow American Freedom Radio. I've been on Roxy Lopez's show and Christine Aphrodite's show. So you've got some good people in this. On this network, and great! I love your promos and your you know, the commercials and everything in between. You know, when we go off, George Carlin and all that, it's wonderful. Sean David's stuff that he does, it's great.
Oh yeah, yeah! You have to give it up for American Freedom Radio and Danny Romero, who owns and kind of runs the show out there. They basically. Whatever work that people think that I'm doing or any of us other radio show hosts on the network, times it by 10, you know, and imagine doing it purely, you know, those kind of Puritans out there who are only doing it for the truth, won't really accept help and all of that kind of stuff because they feel they don't want to be a burden, they just want to get it out there sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of mentality that we deal with. And it shows in the quality of the programming and the amount of, shall we say, borders that are breached. There's no taboo topics on this network. It's anything and everything at all at the same time.
And, you know, I was doing interview shows like this probably as early, as recently as maybe 5 years ago or so, and that really was not the case at that time. At that time, there were still a whole bunch of taboos, and I had to be kind of careful. I had to be kind of careful what I said, you know, because I didn't want to just lose everybody, you know, right out of the chute. So things are kind of moving along as far as that's concerned. And it's so refreshing not to have to be careful what I say. I mean, God, I can't tell you how wonderful that is. I don't have to worry about talking about ETs, or I don't have to worry about talking about conspiracies or all this stuff. Just it's so refreshing not to have to worry about that, as opposed to, you know, how much can this audience tolerate? You know, because I don't want to be blowing people's circuits, and, you know, I don't want to get them, you know, just, you know, tuning out because, you know, it's too, you know, it's too crazy for them. I mean, I don't want to do that. So what a wonderful development that is, that things are opening up in that way.
Mm-hmm. And on the subject of
because I even find some of the social groups that I hang around with, there are certain topics that people just it's not that they're not open to it, but they just don't get it. You know, even some of the more enlightened groups that I hang around with, a lot of the people just don't get the whole chemtrails phenomenon and how vast it is. For example, sunsets that we have these days, you know, that are all these brilliant colors and all these lines and all these streaks, and, you know, on one level it's really very beautiful, and everyone's going, oh God, look at the beautiful sunset, oh isn't it wonderful, you know, that we're so blessed with such beauty, blah blah blah. And I don't want to be the one to say, hey gang, you know, there's a bunch of aluminum up in the air there, and it's, you know, it's refracting and it's making those colors and it's all an illusion. So, anyway.
Yeah. So something happened like that to me. I think I was coming home from my mate's place, like, real late at night. I think it might have been, like, 2, 3 in the morning or something like that. And I looked up in the sky, and it was a full moon, and the moon was casting rainbows.
Right.
Like, literal. There were just rings of rainbow around the moon. It was quite extraordinary. And there was no cloud.
Oh, okay.
It was weird, man. And I've never seen anything like that before in all my life. Wow. But on the subject of aliens, I came up with a Yo Mama joke yesterday, if you'd like to hear it.
Sure.
Your mama's so dumb, she thought Grey's Anatomy was about alien autopsy.
Okay. That's good. I like that.
Yeah, I just come up with lame jokes all the time. It's kind of my thing. But anyway, going on to more serious.
Humor, and I love how you can admit so freely to people that you don't know how to make money. That happens to be one of my failings in life. Also, I'm also very, very bad at making money. I'm just too too naive or something. I don't know, too honest. I don't know what it is, but I don't know how to make money either.
I think we're in a truth movement now. Like there's people out there who are trying to seek truth, whatever that truth might be, right? And it's of my opinion that the truth movement itself is very splintered. And it ain't all singing kumbaya and campfires out there, man. There's a lot of infighting, a lot of people like slinging accusations back and forth, that kind of stuff. It's horrendous behind the scenes. A lot of the listeners don't get it. And I want to kind of be as forthcoming and as pathologically honest as I can be, because as far as I know, the only way that you're ever going to get the truth accepted is if it's constantly put out there. You know, people don't accept things that are put in front of them once only and then taken away. I believe that you have to be fully honest at all times of the day and night. But of course, there's some things that I do keep private. But the rest of it is just so much part of trying to create a world where I feel that I can be accepted for whatever I say, and don't have to worry about being arbitrarily judged by others. And when they do, on the other hand, react badly to me being honest, what they've done is they've simply identified themselves as somebody who can't handle the truth. And they'll usually abuse me or something like that, and then they get blocked from Facebook and YouTube. And I never have to deal with that annoying person again. It's great. Right. If you tell the truth, those who are ready to accept it will follow you and be encouraged by you. Those who are not prepared to accept it will simply identify themselves for elimination of my social circle. That's what I'm talking about. Put the little bait out there, you know what I'm saying? All right, we'll be right back with Jack Ellis, ladies and gentlemen. Back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on the fabulous AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Also, if you'd like to see the webcam version of the show, I am filmed each day while doing it, so you can go to my YouTube channel, Mr. News Guerrilla Media. That's Mr. News, MR News Guerrilla Media, with I think it's got the one R, kind of like a pirate, Guerrilla Media. Yeah. And there's also a link to it on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com under the Eugenics logo. As opposed to YouTube, it's Eugenics. Thank you very much. All right. My very special guest, Jack Ellis, is here for the duration of this hour. Now, Jack, I was wondering, if you've got a whole bunch of knowledge and it's all in your head and you want to get it out to people, but you can't, what is the methodology for you? I mean, have you been through periods of time where you've been trying to get this out and just people wouldn't get you on the radio shows or anything like that? What would you do?
Oh, yes, I have. And when I started out in this genre, if you will, this alternative genre, this conspiracy genre, this spirituality genre, 10 years ago or so, nobody really wanted to talk to me anywhere. And it was also back in those days. For example, back in those days, too, David Icke was just about as taboo as somebody could possibly be. You know, I mean, he was just this weirdo who believed in all this reptilian stuff, and he was just an all-time scumbag. And I have noticed, over the years, there's so much more of an acceptance of these. Particularly about 5 years ago, people started being more and more open. You mentioned a minute ago how when you're with people who you were expressing, your version of the truth to, and they weren't buying it, and they would tend to be, judgmental, and maybe would get on your case and maybe start insulting you or whatever. That was also the case with me for many years. But then I noticed about 5 years ago, I noticed a slight difference. I noticed that when I was expressing myself, to people about, my version of, the alternative truth and those kinds of things, I noticed that even though people may not have believed what I was saying, they may not have bought it, and it didn't fit into their world, I noticed that suddenly people were more open as opposed to just completely shut down and reacting defensively. All of a sudden, people were more open, and it was kind of like, rather than saying, oh, you scumbag, you're not patriotic, people died for that, in World War II, blah, 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 and getting all insulting and vilifying me, all of a sudden there was more of an openness in terms of people were just kind of like, that sounds pretty crazy, but, there was more of an openness there as opposed to, so in other words, there was a part of them on some level was, it was getting in and they were hearing it and buying it and not completely, rebelling against it totally. So that was very refreshing. But to answer your question, as far as whether or not I'm getting through, as far as whether or not people are listening, I never cared about that. And maybe that's one of the reasons why I haven't been dramatically successful in terms of, being on a bestseller list or, making all kinds of money like Deepak Chopra or something like that. I never really cared whether or not people were listening. I never cared whether or not people bought my books. I never cared whether or not people were buying it. for myself, all the most important thing for me to do was simply to write what I was writing, to believe what I was believing, to say what I was saying on stage. And if everybody thought I was crazy, that was absolutely fine. I just didn't care. I didn't care in the slightest. And I noticed about 5 years ago or so, there was much more of an acceptance of this message. You know, so I could get to the point where I could, you know, talk in front of hundreds of people, and not be vilified, not be disapproved of, not be, you know, hooted off the stage or heckled off the stage, you know, whatever it might be. But I never cared about that, Vinny. I never cared whether people bought it. I never cared whether people believed it. I just proceeded to, you know, there were only a few people that I cared about. I cared about my publisher. You know, I wanted my publisher to keep publishing my books, and my publisher believed in all this stuff, so that was fine. And I just never cared. And you know, it never really made any difference either. And I also noticed that there's two ways that we can get information out into the world. One way is through our thoughts and ideas. It's through the things that we write about in our books, or the things that we you know, that are in our DVDs, you know, that people can watch in our DVDs. You know, more of the intellectual aspect of things, or the idea aspect of things. And that's one way, you know, to get our message across. But there's another way of getting our message across, and it's equally as important. And that has to do with what we emanate, what kind of a vibration, you know, that we have. Because I think it's equally as important for us to be able to connect with people, not only to be able to connect with people in a mass way, you know, such as connecting with people on a radio show or connecting with people by virtue of buying books, but just to be able to connect with people on a day-to-day basis, you know, when we're, you know, at the health food store, or when we're at the bank, or when we're, you know, doing whatever we're doing, you know, just as we live our lives. To be able to emanate, in other words, it's not what we say, it's not necessarily the ideas that we express. And I've always believed that those things were always kind of less important than the actual, you know, vibration that we emanated, or that the feeling, you know, that people get from us. Because, you know, once we emanate properly, and once the vibration that we emanate is something that people resonate with, once we can connect on that level, then the other stuff is gonna come through, is gonna filter through much more easily in terms of people being, you know, being receptive to whatever we say, or being receptive to the ideas or something like that. So that's another way that we have of communicating these things, or, you know, getting these things across to people, is not you know, what it is we say, but it's who we are as a person and how we live our lives. A very important part of my message, of the message that I've been, you know, communicating now for a while, in regards to the shift, in regards to, you know, the spiritual aspect in all this, is not only the things that I say in my books and the things that I say in my DVDs, but it's also the way that I live my life. I think it's very important that we embody our message, you know, that people can understand our message by watching how we live, and by watching the things that we do, and watching the actions that we take. Because so much of this knowledge, so much of this information, you know, is just so meaningless unless it's translated into practical action, you know, unless it's translated into our lifestyle. And that's such an important thing in relationship to the shift, and in relationship to this transformation, and in relationship to this opportunity, you know, to create a new and better world. In order to do that, it's not only necessary for people like you and me to, you know, to believe the things that we believe and to have the ideas that we have about that. But it's necessary for us also to work to change the way that we live, to change our lifestyles, you know, to minimalize, to live more sustainably, you know, to take more responsibility, you know, for our own lives, you know, to learn how to take care of ourselves, you know, as opposed to, you know, relying upon somebody else, you know, to taking care of us. And to have that embodied in our lifestyle. And for me, it's very important also to have to be able to embody these things, you know, through the ways that I practice my spirituality. And for me, one of the most important ways I do that is through the use of ceremony. And it's very much a ceremony kind of on the indigenous model, you know, of ceremony for me consists of, you know, connecting with spirit through prayer, through song, through music, and through doing these things, you know, together with others, you know, in the indigenous model, such as, you know, in ceremonial circles, circles around the fire, circles around candlelit altars, those sorts of things. And that's one of the primary things that I'm doing these days is I'm talking a whole lot less these days. It seems to me, it seems like talk is wearing very, very thin. It's becoming at a time, I think, where it's necessary for us to talk less and to do more as far as these things are concerned. And for me, what that means is when I give my presentations and my book signings and those kinds of things, there is definitely a ceremonial aspect to that now. I mean, I might talk a little bit, but then I'll also, I'll be doing a lot of ceremonial things, such as, talking about ceremony, the types of ceremonial things that I've learned from my Mayan elder friends and I'm learning from my relations in the indigenous communities that I'm connected with, talking about that with people, teaching people about ceremony, and then demonstrating ceremony as far as connecting with spirit with our vibration, with our prayers, with our songs, with our music, and with all the other various ways that we practice ceremony. So kind of a long-winded answer to your question, but there's a lot of different ways to attempt to get our message out there. And there's another aspect of this too, Vinny, and that is the fact that very often if people aren't listening and if people don't want to hear it, in many cases there's really nothing we can do because we really can't we really can't help somebody or we really can't deliver a message to somebody who doesn't want to be helped and who doesn't want to hear anything than what they've already got locked into their heads. And, unfortunately, not everybody's going to get it. And that's kind of a sad thing because, in my opinion, those people who don't get it, as far as the, awakening that's going on and those people who don't get it as far as the importance of us, practicing and enhancing our spirituality is concerned, those people who don't get it, I think, are going to be really struggling in the years ahead. I think the times ahead are going to be very, very challenging for them, and it's going to be a rough ride. And I can only do as much as I can reasonably do to try to get this stuff across, because it's not a rough ride for me. My life is just a joyous adventure, and I wish it was that way for everybody. But we can't help people who aren't who don't want to help themselves. And that's one of the lessons we learn in psychology is. We can't help people who don't want to help themselves. And certainly that's something I learned in my many years of being a cognitive psychotherapist because, I had a lot of clients who were referred to me by, outside sources who didn't know what kind of a match this person would be for me. They just kept coming in out of the blue. And these were people who really didn't want help. These are people who just basically wanted to be told that it was okay for them to be as crazy as they wanted to be, and they just wanted the world to say that was okay. And so there really was nothing I could do for those people, which was kind of sad. It's kind of like, butting heads, and eventually they would fire me or I'd fire them. But, we can only help people who are willing to help themselves, and sometimes that's just the way it is.
You got to admit, in sales, they teach you the same thing. If you're trying to convince somebody who is not going to be convinced, you're much better off actually just leaving that person to their own devices and going find somebody else who might be easily convinced. Otherwise, you spend all your time and you wind up with no money to spend.
Didn't you also learn in sales, too, that it wasn't as much a function of what you said, but it was a function of the vibration that you emanated? You could be your best.
You've got to have a smile
on a day where you were feeling good and having a good day, and you're in a good mood, and you just had a good, aura about you that people would pick up on to the point where they say, "Boy, whatever it is he's selling, I want some of that." As opposed to you agonizing over whatever it is that you're saying to try to sell whatever it was about the vacuum cleaner that was appealing, rather than stressing over the words. It's much more important, who we are and what we emanate, as opposed to, as opposed to the words we say.
I don't know. I think it's partly that. What was it? Something like 80% of communication is not the words you use. There's body language. There's eye contact. There's smiles on your dials, etc.
Right.
And what I found is, if you're talking like this and you've got a smile on your face, people are more inclined to listen to you because you put happy vibes across it. Whereas if you're talking like this and you don't really give a flying frag,
right,
they're probably not going to either.
Or if you're just being real linear and real analytic and really, just explaining things like, from the booklet, kind of thing. That just puts people right to sleep.
Yeah, they want to talk to a human.
What's that?
You know, They want to talk to humans. That's what people are about.
Somebody who makes them feel good. The workforce
has been adept, particularly people who work in bureaucracies, to cease human contact. Basically, there is either you want to like. This is how I look at it. It's illegal for you in as a soldier, for instance, to follow an illegal order. Ergo, it would be illegal for you, in my opinion, to follow a law if that law is wrong. You know what I'm saying? But what has happened now is that we have gone so robotic is that we don't know the difference between right and wrong and correct and wrong. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, people have started to live lives that are not only not their own, but also detrimental to themselves. They live their lives according to other people's rules. And my answer to the question of how would you get the message out if nobody wants to listen? Any way you can. Every way you can. Experiment. Try this. Try that. If you get some success in some area, do more of it. And if it keeps getting bigger, you're on the right track. That kind of thing.
Right.
I believe that life is about, if you want to solve a problem, experiment and as much as humanly possible to try and find a possible solution.
And, you know, Vinny, that's one of the, because I was thinking of just what you're saying. I was thinking of that about a half hour ago when you were talking about knowing what you don't want, but then not necessarily knowing how to discover what you do want. And then you said, oh, I just fell into it. Because the answer to that is, you know, the first step is for us to know what we don't want. Or as human beings, the first step is for us to know who we don't want to be. You know, I don't want to be that depressed, angry person who's just miserable all the time. You know, I don't want to be that.
Indeed. Unfortunately, we've got some ads, so be depressed and miserable over the place. We'll be right back.
Wayne rappers, but I've never been edible. I'm a cracker, not a vegetable, fed to an extraterrestrial. The beat is so electrical, it'll pump your heart ventricles, but I bet you will eject it if I start getting intellectual. I am not yet credible, so until I can say I'm credible, I'll say that I'm incredible, respectable.
Trying to keep it gangster.
Do you read me? Am I legible?
For all y'all Federal Reserve employees out there, keeping it not real with the debt bubble and shit and stuff. On AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Jack Ellis is my very special guest, and we were kind of cut you off during the break here. Do you remember what you were talking about?
I do. And let me just pick it up. There's two things going on here. One thing is learning what we don't want or learning who we don't want to be. And then quite a different thing is once we learn that, then it's a question of, you know, what do we want or who do we want to be? And you made the statement that you weren't sure how prior to everything happening for you, you weren't sure how to find that. You weren't sure how to discover that. And you said, well, I just fell into it. And one of the things that I've learned working with people individually for so long, not only in the psychotherapy work I did for so long, but in working now with people on their individual and spiritual growth, is that that happens to be one of the things that people are more terrified of than anything, because they get to the point where they learn who they don't want to be, and they even learn how they can let go of that person they don't want to be, that depressed, angry, you know, unhappy person. They get a sense of learning understanding how it all works, and learning how it works in their mind, and learning how it feels in their body, and they get to the point where they're familiar with it, and they can begin to let that go. But then there's a question of, well, now that I've let that go, who am I? And it's at that point where people have even a more difficult time than they had before, because basically what they're doing is they're kind of staring into the void, you know, because there's nothing there anymore. You know, the person they've always been is gone, or is at least, you know, being let go of. So what they're doing is they're basically looking into a void, and people get really, really scared under those circumstances. And my advice to them is always the same, and it's the same thing that you just said. My advice to them is, well, in order for you to discover who you want to be, there's only one way to do that, and that's to start exploring, to start experimenting, to start just arbitrarily, you know, just going places, doing things, you know, going to workshops, going to movies, going whatever, you know, just you know, going on, you know, traveling to places you've never been to before, you know, looking at cultures you've never, you've never visited before, don't know anything about. Experiment, explore. And it was at that point where most people resisted, you know, changing so much that they would rather go back to their old, you know, crazy self that they were before. They would rather do that, you know, than look into this gaping void of nothingness. And it's an interesting phenomenon. It's an interesting way that we're wired as human beings, where that aspect of nothing, you know, would be more terrifying to us than anything. But that's something that we need to learn how to just, to be with and to be okay with, you know, rather than, because for those of us who are, you know, launched to, you know, for me on my own path that I've been on for many years now, and I refer to it as the spiritual path that I've been on, one of the primary features of this path is continually taking leaps into the unknown, continually. It's kind of like any time, I reach a, you know, an incredible challenge and begin to understand the nature of the challenge, that the way to work myself through the challenge is to move into areas, you know, that I've never moved into before, that I'm completely unfamiliar with, which is the equivalent of leaping into the unknown. And in the past, when I used to leap into the unknown, it was terrifying to me. And I can relate to how people would, you know, resist that so intensely. But I've gotten to the point now, understanding this process and understanding how all this works and knowing that I'm going to be continuing to make this leap into the unknown, you know, as I continue to move forward, that it's going to continue to happen. And as a matter of fact, I'm kind of going through that now in many ways in terms of understanding new aspects of myself and kind of leaping into new aspects of myself. So it's essential to understand how this process works. And to take these leaps into the unknown and to do it joyfully, you know, to do it willingly, to do it joyfully and to enjoy it. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know where I'm going to end up. I don't know what I'm going to learn. You know, I'm basically just flying through space and, you know, I don't know what's happening here. But this is the nature of it, and I'm going to trust that, you know, because I know I don't want to go back, you know, to the way it was before. And this is the nature of, you know, what it is to change, what it is to let go of something that's been there for a long time, what it is to let go of those things, and then to experience, you know, the newness of whatever's next. So, yes, taking leaps into the unknown and doing it willingly and joyfully, and that's the way that we learn, and it's okay. You know, we don't always have to know the answers. We don't always have to know who we are. There doesn't always have to be some guiding structure. You know, sometimes we're just, you know, flying through space and we don't know what the heck is happening. And that's a wonderful thing, and that's how we're going to learn, you know, whatever it is that we need to learn next.
I completely agree with that, and it comes down to two words, and they're the two most freeing words, and they rhyme with bucket. You just go, well, bucket, man. I'm gonna, and that's how I get into things. You go into
that's
it joyfully.
I throw
myself into things recklessly by just going bucket. And sure enough, out of a lack of concern for an uncertain outcome, I wind up having a joyful, reckless existence. You know what I'm saying? You know.
Right.
And
right.
Occasionally you mess up though, and you get these real bad experiences. But I look at it like this:
well,
all of those
of
bad
process,
experiences
right?
teach you something, right? It's like if you've got Legos, if you ever played with Legos as a kid, you know, each one of those experiences that you have in your life, good or bad, is another Lego block that you've got for which you can build another interesting creation out of, a spaceship or anything, right? And what I do in order to, I don't know, flippantly kind of bounce around the universe in my own way without running into anything and getting closed off about it, I just assume that I'm wrong. All right, and if I am actually wrong, somebody will come up at some point and prove it to me. It's like, thank you very much. I was right about being wrong. And so, you know, you've only got two outcomes that are possible. Then you're either wrong, which means you're right, or you're pleasantly surprised.
Uh-huh. Yeah, when we take leaps into the unknown, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, and sometimes the outcome. We can't guarantee a positive outcome. You know, when we experiment with things, you know, we don't always know what the result of the experiment is going to be, and it's not always going to be. Sometimes when we experiment with things, you know, we experiment with, you know, nine things, you know, that don't work, before we find, you know, something that does work. And the way that we make the distinction, and this is an important part of this whole thing, is basically by learning to trust, you know, our own heart and to trust our own feelings. You know, we can't always, you know, just be analyzing things in our heads, because that's going to, you know, that will lead us astray at some point. You know, we just need to trust our hearts, and when we're experiencing something, it really feels right. You know, we say, yeah, this feels right. I want to stay with this for a while. Those other 9 things I did, you know, that didn't feel right. I didn't want to stay there. It didn't work for me. But this feels good. You know, I want to learn more about this. And it's very, very important to learn to trust ourselves. Very, very important.
Yeah. It's like, did this make me happy?
The only way we learn it, too, is by practicing. You know, if we learn how not to trust ourselves, you know, as a function of how we're brought up or our parents or whatever, you know, if we learn how not to trust ourselves, you know, then that becomes the norm. And so learning how to trust ourselves is something that, you know, that we have to practice and something we have to learn as a function of experimenting and leaping into the unknown and, you know, learning how to discern, you know, what works versus what doesn't work. But once again, I'm going to say what I said earlier. What better thing do we have to do with our life? You know, than exactly what we're describing. You know, experimenting with life, experimenting with new things, and leaping into the unknown. You know, what better thing do we have to do with our lives?
I think that's the question everybody kind of spends a lot of their life asking, but never trying to answer. Like, it's a rhetorical question: Who am I? How did I get here? What is my purpose in life? You know. You're supposed to actually try and figure out what the answer to that is, not just sitting around repeating the same question. You're not even quantifying or even reviewing or better understanding the question. Just go out there and find out. You know, the world's open for you. It's an oyster, baby. There's 7 billion people on this planet you can hang out with and do fun things with. Why wouldn't you? What do you got to lose?
You know, one of the most important lessons I've learned on this path, and something that you know that I'm certain is going to be very, very enduring for me. And this again is a message that I've learned from my Mayan elder friend and from my indigenous relations, because in the indigenous cultures, the indigenous traditions are basically based upon, you know, what I'm about to say, and that is that this life of mine here in this world, it's not about me. It's not about me. And in our Western civilization and in our old paradigm world, it's all about us. It's all about us as individuals. It's all about making money, and it's all about being successful, and it's all about, you know, having a spouse that's, you know, great looking and having kids that are great, and it's all about us, and it's all about our achievement. And one of the things that I've learned from my indigenous relations is that it's not about us. What it is about, it's about our relationship with the creation, which boils down to, it's not about us at all. It's about essentially learning that we are a very small part in a much bigger whole. And this whole that I'm referring to is basically the web of life. You know, it's the web of life, you know, of which we as human beings are an integral part and a co-creative part. And what we learn is that it's not about us, but it is about playing our part, or it's about serving the web of life, you know, playing our part in this bigger whole. And once we learn that, we can kind of give up, you know, a lot of the things which turn out to be obstacles. And it's a very freeing experience, learning that it's not about us, and it is in fact about our relationship with serving the web of life.
But that's kind of like what I was thinking just yesterday, as it turns out. My life does not improve by me having power over other people. My life only improves if I adopt myself to servitude of other people, because they appreciate it and help me back in return. And that's what it is, ladies and gentlemen. It's a big deal. Keep pushing out and out. Better get on it before it stops spinning altogether. Thank you very much, Jack Ellis. You can Google him and get his book, ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to. We'll see you again sometime.